It's a cold evening on the 27th of September in 2019. In the small County Cavan town of Ballyconnell, parish priest Father Oliver O'Reilly looks out at his congregation and prepares to speak. He knows what he has to say will be controversial. He knows it may be dangerous for him, but he will not be silent. He wants to talk about a man he knows, a decent man, a father of six. This man has been attacked, tortured, left permanently marked by an act of sadistic cruelty. He is the latest victim of a long-running campaign of intimidation in the borderlands of counties Cavan and Fermanagh. The attack on him was so barbaric that all of Ireland knows about it. The entire country knows the man's name. Ireland is shocked. The nation is outraged. But on this September night, standing beneath the high ceiling of Ballyconnell Church, things are less clear. Here, it is never black and white. You can never be sure who is on your side and who is not. And now, it will take bravery to speak that name from the altar. He clears his throat. He speaks of the attack. He calls it a modern crucifixion. He calls it barbaric and depraved, and an act carried out by hired savage thugs. "We have all been hoodwinked," he says, looking from one face to another among the polished wooden pews. He speaks of threats and violent intimidation running through their area for years. He warns there is a mafia-style group working at the behest of a godfather figure. He tells the congregation there is a cancer of evil in their midst. He calls on them to stand up to this threat, and whoever is behind it. After Mass, Father O'Reilly stands outside the church, shaking hands with parishioners. Some are supportive of his message, but not all. Here, it is never black and white. "Mind your own business," someone tells him. "His car will probably be burnt out," warns another. Later that night, back in his home, the telephone rings. The caller says two words before hanging up. "Watch yourself." When someone is murdered in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a team of forensic scenes of crime examiners from the Technical Bureau. For 25 years, I was a part of that team. My name is John Sweetman. I was there to help read the silent and often hidden clues at a crime scene. I saw what killers tried to hide. Fingerprints unknowingly left behind. Murder weapons hidden in plain sight. Handwriting that betrayed a lie. Every detail told the real story, and now I'll tell you those stories. In this podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting crimes. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that looks beyond the headlines, following the evidence step by step and uncovering the stories behind the investigations. In this episode, the campaign of intimidation, harassment and violence against Kevin Lunny. Tony Lunny had just sat down on his sofa with a cup of tea on the evening of the 17th of September in 2019, when the family landline at his Cavan home started to ring. Tony left it to his wife to answer. The 55-year-old had finished up work for the day. The evening news was on and his mobile phone was on silent. It was time to unwind. But Tony's peace couldn't last. Jerry Maguire was on the line. He was a colleague from Quinn Industrial Holdings, or QIH, where Tony was a director. He couldn't ignore the call. But the call wasn't work-related. Jerry lived close to Kevin Lunny, Tony's younger brother. Kevin was also a director at the company. "Something was wrong," Jerry said. Kevin's Jeep was on fire outside his home in Kinnaly, County Fermanagh. there was no sign of Kevin. Tony got into his car to make the short trip from his home to Kevin's. He had seen his 50-year-old brother before he left the office that day. That was around 6 p.m. Kevin was going to hang on for another 20 minutes or so before heading home to his wife and six children. From his car, Tony tried to call two of his brothers, Peter and Frank. They were from a family of 10, and Kevin was the baby, while Tony was the second youngest. Tony called them the two boys at the end. It would bring a smile to his face thinking about it. The brothers all lived a short drive from each other. Peter and Frank just a few minutes away from Kevin, and Tony a 10-minute drive. The three brothers all arrived at Kevin's home at the same time. Kevin's Jeep, a Toyota Land Cruiser, was consumed by flames. Jerry had called the fire brigade and the police service of Northern Ireland. Tony hoped they wouldn't be long. He knew Jerry was worried about Kevin's whereabouts and that he might even have been in the Jeep at the time of the fire. But Tony couldn't let his mind go there. Tony went into a nearby field and saw another car on fire, around 30 metres further up the lane from Kevin's house. He started to piece it together. Kevin's Jeep had been blocked into the lane. He now felt his brother wasn't in the burning car, but was lying unconscious somewhere, or maybe even taken away. He called the Gardaí in Cavan. He was worried about his own home. His wife and two children were there. His brother was missing. There were other people to warn too. Others who would be as worried about Kevin as he was. Liam McCaffrey, the chief executive of QIH, had 5 missed calls on his phone when he arrived home after a run. Tony Lunny had been calling him. Liam was just about to call back when Tony rang again. "Liam, are you safe?" Tony asked. "Kevin's missing." Liam listened as he heard about Kevin's Jeep on fire. Still in his running gear, he grabbed his car keys and left to be with Tony. In Leitrim, John McCartan, another director of QIH, was at home with his family when a Garda called to his house. He wanted to know if John was okay. "Why would that be?" John asked. The guard explained he had been sent to check on him. His colleague Kevin Lunny was missing and his car was on fire. Liam and his other colleagues needed to be accounted for too. When the fire brigade put out the fire, it was only then that Tony was sure Kevin wasn't in the car. He felt a relief, but only briefly. Where was Kevin? Scenarios of what could have happened ran through Tony's head. Had Kevin been in a fight and fallen somewhere near his home? Was he hurt and lying in a field? Tony started combing the ditches, shouting for his brother, in the hope Kevin would hear him. There was no response. Around the same time, at 8:45 that night, Aaron Brady, a young farmer, was driving his tractor home across the border in County Cavan. As he came to a crossroads, he noticed something in a ditch. As he looked down from his tractor, an arm rose slowly into the cool, dark evening. Aaron stopped the tractor and jumped down to get a closer look. A man was lying in the ditch. His body was cut and covered in blood, and he was shivering and shaking. He wore only boxer shorts. Aaron didn't know what to do. He wondered if this was a prank. He called his mother. She was only up the road. Another woman, Celine Deignan, was passing in her car when she saw Aaron's tractor. She stopped just as Aaron's mother arrived in her own car. Aaron's mother approached the man in the ditch. The man tried to get some words out. The two women and Aaron leaned in to make out his words. They heard him say something to do with a dispute in Quinns. He wanted to call his wife. As Celine got closer, she recognized the man. It was Kevin Lunny. He had been a director in Quinn Insurance, a now defunct company where she had once worked. She knew all about the Quinn dispute too. Everyone in the area knew about it. Aaron's mother rang the emergency services and the Gardaí. Then she called Kevin's wife, Brona Lunny. The women covered Kevin's body with whatever clothing was in their cars. They found some pajamas and fed him 7-Up. Help was on the way, they told him. In Fermanagh, the PSNI had cordoned off the laneway with Kevin's burnt-out Jeep, and the conversation had turned to ramping up the search with sniffer dogs and a police helicopter, when someone shouted that Kevin had been found. He was in Cavan. Tony called the Gardaí in Cavan immediately. "Kevin is in Cavan," he told them. "Where is he?" But the Gardaí didn't know. They hadn't heard anything. Frank Lunny rushed towards Tony. He had spoken to a woman who was with Kevin. Kevin was alive. Gardaí were with him and an ambulance was on the way. They were taking him to Cavan General Hospital. The Lunny brothers and Brona arrived before the ambulance at the hospital. When they saw Kevin, he was wrapped up and in agony. They stayed with him until 6:30 the following morning. They knew it was a miracle that Aaron Brady had seen Kevin. If he hadn't, Kevin might have died. Kevin Lunny had been stripped, beaten, and left for dead. His body had been dumped on a road with few passers-by. His attackers had carved the letters QIH into his chest. Somehow, Kevin Lunny had banked key memories from that evening. He could recall landmarks and conversations. He could piece together a timeline that would present Gardaí and PSNI officers with a detailed map of what happened. Kevin's memories would be the first step on a long road. He remembered leaving the QIH offices in Derry Lynn and making the short 5-kilometer drive home to Canali. It was a sunny day, and he wanted to get home and enjoy the fine evening with his wife and 6 children. He was looking forward to it. As Kevin turned his Jeep off the main road and into the laneway towards his house, he saw a silver BMW. It was 2/3 of the way up the laneway, close to the entrance of his home. Kevin stopped. This was unusual. Strange cars didn't park on this lane, and especially outside his home. The BMW began to reverse at speed towards him. It looked like the car almost jumped on the road as it reversed at top speed. He didn't have much time to react. The silver car smashed into the front of his Jeep. He watched in horror as his own car crumpled in front of his eyes. Still reeling from the impact, Kevin then saw 2 men get out of the BMW. They were wearing balaclavas and dressed in black. They had something in their hands. The driver was carrying 2 cans of clear liquid, and both men had cable ties hanging on their arms. The driver was slightly taller than Kevin, and more athletic. His accomplice was a slimmer man. They walked towards the damaged Jeep. One of the men went to the driver window, and the other to the front passenger window. Kevin was frozen with fear. The Jeep engine was still running. The men started banging on the windows. Kevin locked his doors. He needed to get help. He looked around for his phone. He was shaking. He was confused. He needed help. But he found he couldn't do anything beyond pushing his seat back. His fingers wouldn't work as he clumsily tried to punch in numbers on his phone. He couldn't. His body had frozen. Kevin heard the sound of breaking glass surrounding him. The driver of the BMW had smashed the window to his right. His accomplice smashed the window to his left. They were now able to open his Jeep. Kevin was trapped. He shifted over to his left and moved into the back of the Jeep. One of the men entered the car. He was in the front seats Kevin had just wriggled free from, and he was removing the headrest. He was trying to remove any obstacles between him and Kevin. Kevin fought back. He kicked the man in the shoulder and head. He grabbed the man's black balaclava, but it wouldn't come off. Still, Kevin caught a glimpse of the man's face. He had short, light brown or blonde hair. Kevin couldn't be sure, but he did see stubble on the man's face. Kevin's retaliation disarmed the assailant for a moment as he pulled away to fix his disguise. But there was no time for Kevin to make use of this distraction. The man's accomplice opened the back passenger door. Kevin kept fighting. The man grabbed Kevin's phone. Any chance to get help was gone. The man lunged towards Kevin. Kevin felt himself being dragged from the Jeep. He tried to wrestle free of the two men, but he couldn't. And now there was a third man. A man taller, heavier, and older than the other two men. He had a knife. A Stanley knife. He held it up to Kevin's neck, and the men took his wallet and threw it on the ground. They frisked his body. The knife moved down to his wrist and sliced off his watch. "We want to talk to you," the man with the knife said. Kevin heard a Dublin accent. "Get into that," the man ordered. Kevin didn't understand. He was still resisting as best he could, desperately trying to wriggle free from the men. "If you don't get into that, we'll kill you." The man's words rang in Kevin's head. "Get in where?" he wondered. Then, as his eyes moved from the men, he saw what they meant. Behind his car, another car had arrived. He hadn't heard it approach. It was a black Audi A4 saloon car, with a Cork registration number. Its boot was wide open. The men were telling Kevin to get into the boot. The car was facing forward from the laneway to the main road. The driver had reversed in. Now Kevin was pinned in from every side, with a car on either side of his Jeep and three men surrounding him. He tried to fight back, but it was useless. He was bundled into the boot and his world turned black. He heard the men get into the car. The Audi sped away from the laneway and turned left onto the main road, the opposite route Kevin had driven home earlier that evening. He was being taken towards the Irish border. Once the boot of the Audi closed, the men set fire to Kevin's Jeep, leaving it in the laneway to burn, along with their own silver BMW, which they had launched their attack with. From inside the boot, Kevin tried everything to free himself. He pulled some carpet away from the boot, hoping a piece of metal he could feel would unlock the latch. But it broke in his hand. Still, he kept trying, and when he finally felt the latch, the boot swung open. Kevin hoisted himself up, swinging one leg out of the boot in the hope of escaping. But the car was traveling much too fast. The sole of Kevin's shoe ripped right off as he touched the road. He knew if his head or arm had touched the road first, it was going to rip him apart. Escaping wasn't an option. Shouting came from inside the car. "He's opened the fucking boot." The back seat was pushed down and one of the men grabbed Kevin's other leg. The car stopped and the men stood at the boot, with the Stanley knife back at Kevin's neck. They told him they were going to kill him if he didn't get back into the car. They were angry. Kevin tried to look around to see where he was. And then he felt it. A wooden object smacked against the left side of his face. For 45 minutes, Kevin Lunny lay in the boot of the black Audi. Even without a watch, he could feel the minutes add up. The boot wasn't closing properly since his escape attempt. The back seat was pushed down so one of the men could hold onto him. Kevin could see out of the boot, and he could see out of a window. He memorized anything that told him where he was going, a Lakeland Dairy sign, a pub with a sign painted in a cream color down one side of its walls. he had a better view of the man holding him too. He wore a black top with a white Under Armour logo at his waist. Kevin could sense the man was agitated. "Did Kevin have a tracker?" he asked. "Did Kevin have another phone?" "Stop looking out the window," the kidnapper ordered, before putting material of some sort over Kevin's face. While Kevin's sight was compromised, he could still hear the men's conversations. One of them was on the phone. He told whoever was on the other end of the line, "Boss, this man has resisted and we've had to hit him." Now Kevin knew there was another player in all of this. These men weren't acting alone. Someone had instructed them to do this to him. "Boss," the man had said. The car stopped. Kevin was sick and sore. The men didn't care. He heard one giving out about what Kevin had done to the car. "He broke the fucking boot," one of them said, as he tried to get it open to pull Kevin out. Kevin's head was still covered, but he caught glimpses of his surroundings. The ground was overgrown with weeds. There was a white building off to the side, and he was being pushed towards a metal box, a blue container. Beside it was a white trailer and another building, this time brown. The blue metal box Kevin found himself in stank. The foul smell of animal dung. He must be in a horse box, he thought. And then one of the men spoke. "Do you know why you're here?" "No," Kevin answered. He wondered if he was finally going to learn why these men had taken him from his family, an ordinary Tuesday that had morphed into a living nightmare. The man told him, "You are here because of Quinn Industrial Holdings. You are going to resign." Now Kevin knew his job, his livelihood, was the reason for the kidnapping. "You destroyed the company, and you have done damage." The men said three other directors had to quit too. Kevin knew the men were serious. Their tone, their words, their actions. The men repeated again, this time more aggressively, "You are going to resign." Kevin knew he had to answer, and there could only be one right answer. Beaten, bloodied, broken, Kevin replied, "Yes, yes." The men had more demands. Kevin must drop two court cases that his company were involved in. He promised he would. He would tell the other directors. He told them he would do whatever they wanted. He just asked that they wouldn't kill him. The men knew things, like how his daughter played GAA, or how Kevin had attended an event with her in Fermanagh the weekend before. One of the men said, "We know about your daughter in the GAA top. We have been watching you for 6 weeks, and if you don't do what we say, we will come back." He had promised to do everything they wanted. He knew his family were in danger. He wanted to go home. But his kidnappers weren't finished. They had delivered their ultimatums, and now was the time for some housekeeping. The driver of the BMW that reversed into Kevin's Jeep said there were forensic details that needed addressing, like DNA or other evidence linking them to the kidnapping. Taking the Stanley knife, he began to scrape underneath Kevin's fingernails. Kevin's hand started to bleed. They took Kevin's glasses and eye drops from his shirt and poured the drops on his hands, but it wasn't enough to clean the evidence away. They needed more. They decided they needed bleach, and the drivers of the BMW and the Audi left. The remaining kidnapper told Kevin to get on his knees. He bound Kevin's hands with cable ties. Kevin asked if he could stand up. He said his knees were hurting. The man said no and tightened the cables even more. The plastic cut into Kevin's skin, and he felt his hands go numb. 15 minutes later, the other two attackers returned with a bottle of Domestos bought from a nearby shop. By now it was dark, and the men carried a torch. Kevin could smell the strong stench of bleach. The men stripped him, cutting off his trousers and nipping his skin as they did. Kevin heard one of the men say he needed to be stripped naked. "No, leave him with his dignity," said another. There, on his knees, and wearing only his boxer shorts, Kevin was drenched in bleach. His head cover was soaked, and the bleach ran into his eyes and mouth. His body was in agony, as bleach soaked into his new wounds. The men handed him a rag and ordered him to rub the bleach into his body. But it wasn't enough. The driver of the Audi told Kevin they would let him go, but before he could be released, they would have to rough him up, he said. "Why?" Kevin asked. "We have to," the man replied. What followed was the brutal torture and mutilation of Kevin Lunny. The men dealt blow after blow with a wooden baton. His right leg was shattered. Kevin cried out in pain. His right side was hit 20 times. Kevin roared in agony. The men repeated that Kevin was going to resign. They repeated that Kevin was going to drop the court cases. And then they told him he had to be marked. They cut Kevin's face from ear to chin on both sides with the Stanley knife. And then the blade moved to his chest, cutting into his skin. They carved the letters QIH. For 45 minutes, Kevin Lunny had been threatened, humiliated, tortured, and scarred. His attackers carried him from the horse box into a Ford Transit van. He was told again about resigning and warned not to go to the Gardaí or tell them that a gang of dubs were responsible. The van slowed down and Kevin heard a door open. Someone lifted the cover on his face before Kevin was pushed out a side door with a warning not to look at the van. Kevin Lunny was dumped in a ditch on a narrow country road. He was badly injured and exhausted, but he was alive. Kevin pulled himself inch by inch. He didn't know where he was. He couldn't use his badly beaten and broken right side. He fixed his sights on a light in a distant house and dragged his body along. And then Aaron Brady drove towards him in his tractor. Kevin Lunny was finally safe. He had been dumped 40 kilometers from his home. The country was united in its repulsion over what had happened to Kevin Lunny. His physical scars were brutal and barbaric. He had been beaten, cut, and tortured. He had been scored with the letters QIH on his body. In the South, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar condemned the attack, calling it very cowardly and brutal. One newspaper source said Kevin's two-hour abduction was a throwback to the era of provisional IRA punishment beatings. In Fermanagh and Cavan, the depravity of the crimes committed against Kevin Lunny was the latest atrocity in a four-year campaign targeting QIH directors. John McCartan, Kevin Lunny, and Dara O'Reilly had faced a torrent of anger from local organised groups since taking over former Sean Quinn-owned companies with US investors. Quinn had built a business empire in the local area over the previous three decades and had become a local hero to many, as from humble beginnings he amassed a fortune that placed him amongst the richest people in Britain or Ireland. But Quinn had lost his empire and his companies entered bankruptcy. Eventually, Kevin Lunny, his brother Tony, and the other directors had assumed charge of QIH. Tony Lunny felt a narrative had been created around the men being somehow responsible for Sean Quinn being ousted from the business empire he had built. Some felt the Lunnies and others had pushed Quinn out of his businesses and made life intolerable for him to remain at them. And in the wake of those business dealings came the campaign of intimidation against the new directors, a campaign that grew in intensity. Before Kevin Lunny's kidnapping, the QIH business premises had been firebombed. The directors had been threatened, both in person and online. There were arson attacks on their properties and cars. Threats were directed at family members. Directors were physically hurt. Speaking on RTE's prime time 2 months after Kevin's kidnapping, QIH chief executive Liam McCaffrey said acts of intimidation and violence against them began in 2015. One of the most notable that year was at Christmas time. Kevin Lunny had taken his 6 children to visit Santa in the Sleeve Russell Hotel in Cavan. When they returned home, a pig's head had been dumped on his back doorstep. A rigorous online campaign, primarily on Facebook, followed along with posters on local roads carrying words like traitors, money grabbers, and cuckoos painted over the names and photos of the directors. In 2018, machinery was damaged. A lorry was burnt out. Bullets were sent in the post, along with a funeral wreath and warning note. On the 29th of February, 7 months before his abduction, Kevin Lunny was in an Apple Green service station near Ballyconnell in Cavan. It was around lunchtime when he and a colleague, Dara O'Reilly, sat down in the small dining area to have a bite to eat. A man walked towards them with a cup and flung its contents over Dara. It was boiling water. He then turned his attention to Kevin and assaulted him with a ferocious barrage of punches. The man who beat Lunny was an amateur boxer called James Bernard McGovern. Still in his early 20s, he threw punch after punch on Kevin, in an attack later noted for its ferocity and savagery by the judge who jailed the man. Kevin's nose was broken and an eye was damaged in the assault. The reason for the attack was labelled in court as an act of revenge. The boy's father had lost his job at QIH. While McGovern's assault was an isolated one, the organised and deliberate targeting of executives hadn't slowed down. Tony Lunny's factory was targeted that August, followed by an attack on Darrow O'Reilly's car outside his home while he slept with his young family. Then in October, Tony's daughter's car was set on fire. In the same primetime interview, an emotional Tony Lunny told how he was in Edinburgh that Halloween to celebrate his 25-year wedding anniversary with his wife and children. The family were about to go to bed when Tony got the call that the car was on fire. New cameras installed after the arson attack on the factory meant the Lunnies had to watch the car in flames from their phones as they sat together in their room in the hotel. The directors reported each of the attacks to Gardaí, the PSNI, and even the government in the hope of some support. Liam McCaffrey believed if what had been happening to Quinn executives was done to their counterparts in Facebook, Google, or Intel, it would have brought about a national outcry. Sean Quinn condemned the attack on Kevin Lunny and insisted that he had no hand or part, as he put it, in Kevin Lunny's abduction, or indeed any of the violence against those leading his former companies. Yet he had supporters who believed he had been betrayed by the QIH executives. Many in Fermanagh still remembered the county when it was little more than an economic wasteland, as one commentator put it. They remembered Quinn as the man who turned their look around. He was almost a folk hero who had rescued the county and turned its fortunes around. When Sean Quinn, the farmer's son and self-professed dunce who stayed at home milking the cows, started a gravel and later a cement business in Derry Lynn in the early 1970s, Fermanagh was a forgotten county in Northern Ireland. The border county had by then seen its fair share of the troubles. Its population were mostly Catholics, and emigration was often the only option for young people. Jobs and industry in the county were scarce. Over a 30-year period, Sean Quinn built up his business empire in gravel, cement, glass, hospitality and insurance across Fermanagh and Cavan. His company headquarters were built on the site of his family home in Derry Lynn. A large shiny silver Q hung out front. In a three-part documentary about the businessman's life by Trevor Burney, Irish Times columnist Fintan O'Toole said as Quinn's public image started to develop, it was almost as an anti-figure to the hype of the Celtic Tiger. Ireland's economic boom years, from 1994 until 2007. While other successful business figures flaunted their wealth and mixed in high-profile social and political circles, Sean Quinn stayed with his staff. He didn't even own a mobile phone. He was a man of the people. His people. It was an insurance business, Quinn Direct, that saw his fortunes mushroom. It began in 1996 with a young Kevin Lunny as its general manager. He was one of Sean Quinn's loyal lieutenants, along with Liam McCaffrey. With yearly profits in the hundreds of millions of euros, Quinn was allowed by Ireland's financial regulator to entertain borrowings of £800 million of dividends in the early noughties, 5 years before Ireland's economy crashed. By 2007, Sean Quinn was the 12th richest man in Britain and lived in a 15,000 square foot mansion beside his first hotel, the Sleeve Russell in Cavan. He had 9 cars and a swimming pool. His wealth was unmatched in the country. But behind the scenes, he dabbled in high-risk investments, which were then sold and invested in Anglo-Irish Bank, the financial institute that bankrolled Ireland's boom-time property developers. All in, Sean Quinn built up a 25% stake in the company. It was a dangerous game. When the global economy crashed in 2008, banks built primarily on the fortune of an exaggerated property market tumbled one by one. Anglo-Irish Bank was nationalised and renamed the Irish Bank Resolution Corporation, IBRC. The shares were worthless. Sean Quinn was in trouble. By the end of 2011, Sean Quinn, the Fermanagh billionaire, declared himself bankrupt in one of the biggest bankruptcy orders in Britain or Ireland. He owed 2.6 billion euros to the Irish state. The Quinn Group was put in administration. It had to be broken up. The IRBC was taking control. But he also owed 1.2 billion euros to American bondholders. In Fermanagh, the mood was somber as people worried for their jobs and futures. Quinn Insurance was the first to go. Quinn met administrators for a meeting in Dublin to discuss the administration. 300 employees travelled with a petition with 93,000 names, calling for Quinn Direct Insurance to be given back to him. They held placards that read, "Why ruin profitable companies? Stop emigration. Save families." And, "The people have spoken. Please listen." In 2012, rallies were held by a group calling themselves Concerned Irish Citizens in support of Sean Quinn. One protest in October of that year saw 5,000 people clap and cheer Sean Quinn and his wife Patricia and their children as they walked through Ballyconnell. Quinn was being made a scapegoat for Anglo's mistake, people said. Theirs was a hard-working community built from the bottom up, built by Sean Quinn. In 2011, the former Quinn Group was renamed Aventus. Former managers controlled some of the new joint company. It was called Quinn Industrial Holdings Limited, or QIH. But Aventus sold up when a campaign of violence targeted its chief executive. In the meantime, another company was formed between Kevin Lunny, Liam McCaffrey, Dara O'Reilly and a Fine Gael councillor, John McCartan. They called it Quinn Business Retention Company. By this time, the administrators and US bondholders were still owed around 1.1 billion euros. So QBRC and the bondholders set about making a deal, once there was no community interference in the sale of the glass business. Sean Quinn and his son were put on the payroll. Supporters celebrated with Quinn as he moved back into the building, carrying a tray of whiskey and bottles of Budweiser on his return. But Liam McCaffrey was in charge, along with Dara O'Reilly, Kevin Lunny and others. Not Sean Quinn. The working relationship didn't last long, and the Quinns once again left the company. Sean Quinn told supporters he had been pushed out of his business once again. Now the new executive board, including Kevin Lunny, found themselves in the line of fire. The attacks continued, but nobody was ever arrested for the violence. It was never established who, if anyone, was driving the violence or directing it. Sean Quinn condemned the attack on Kevin Lunny. In an interview with Channel 4 News after the kidnapping, he said he no longer wanted his businesses back. When asked why, he responded, "Kevin Lunny." The kidnapping of Kevin Lunny brought the rest of the country up to speed on what communities in the border counties of Fermanagh and Cavan had known for years. The directors, staff, and even contractors working for Quinn Industrial Holdings had long faced a campaign of threats and intimidation. Border communities who lived in fear of the long-escalated violence knew the intimidation had gone too far. Locals reached out to Kevin's family and siblings, and they showed solidarity by attending two masses at Our Lady of Lourdes Church in Ballyconnell, where the local priest Father Oliver O'Reilly condemned the attack. The Rubicon has now been crossed by this most recent barbaric assault. There is now an obvious cancer of evil in our midst that needs to be exorcised before someone is murdered, he told the congregation. He urged people to speak with their neighbours about what had happened. For far too long, people, including himself, had stayed silent. He apologised to Kevin and his extended family for not speaking out about their safety until then. His speech was shared with media outlets and made the headlines. On Monday, the 30th of September, people packed the Canolly Parish Church for a special mass for Kevin. 400 people attended. "We have to show them that they will not win," said one parishioner as he made his way into the church. Gardaí and PSNI officers were under pressure to find Kevin Lunny's abductors. At a cross-border organised crime conference in Cavan, 8 days after Kevin's attack, the Gardaí and PSNI defended their policing track record in border communities. The attacks on QIH directors were no longer confined to provincial news reports. The whole country was talking about Kevin Lunny's kidnapping and the long legacy of violence towards staff in the former Sean Quinn company. To do this properly, the police forces had to work together, and the first All-Ireland Joint Investigation Team was established. Known as a JIT, it would cut out red tape and bureaucratic delays, allowing teams to share information and evidence in real time. Once aligned, they moved quickly. With Kevin's recollections from that evening, the investigation focused on four key areas: CCTV footage, automatic number plate recognition records, mobile phone call data records, and forensic evidence. They already had one key piece of evidence: the car the men burnt out at Kevin's home, along with his Jeep on the night of the abduction. They ran the number plate of the silver 5 Series BMW and found the car had been stolen and the number plate was false. The correct registration was then traced back to CCTV footage at an N4 toll plaza on the evening of the 19th of August, one day after it was stolen in Dublin. The next big lead to work on was the use of bleach in the torture of Kevin Lunny. Lunny remembered one of the gang leaving to buy the bottle, so Gardaí began their inquiries in shops scattered around the Cavan border. They came across one, a gala shop at Killydoon, where a man had bought bleach at 8 p.m. that evening. CCTV showed the buyer of the bleach leaving in a white van. Gardaí were able to identify him. His name was Luke O'Reilly. A man in his 60s, O'Reilly lived in Mullaghore in Lower, Kilcoge, in Cavan. Around 1 p.m. on the 20th of September, Gardaí knocked on his door. "I know why you're here," he told them. "Because I bought that bottle of bleach." O'Reilly said he had nothing to do with Kevin Lunny's abduction. He told them he wouldn't know the man if he met him. He cooperated with Gardaí by handing over his phone. This would prove crucial. It also transpired that Luke O'Reilly owned a yard at Drumbraid in Cavan. A yard with a blue horse box. Forensic teams examined the horse box with luminol, a chemical agent used to detect traces of blood that are invisible to the naked eye. As the blue glow of the luminol was cast across the steel interior of the box, it started to show something. There was blood. Kevin's blood. When O'Reilly's phone records were checked, two calls stood out around the time of the abduction. O'Reilly had made a call to an 085 mobile phone number, an Irish number, at 7:30 that evening. The call lasted 4 minutes. The same number called O'Reilly back just before 8 p.m. That call lasted for 42 seconds. It had also called O'Reilly the previous night, for almost 18 minutes. When Gardaí found out who the number belonged to, the kidnapping of Kevin Lunny became even more sinister. The number belonged to 54-year-old Cyril McGuinness, a criminal known as Dublin Jimmy. He was considered something of a criminal mastermind and a gangster known to police on both sides of the border. Born in Swords, McGuinness was a known criminal and smuggler and had been linked in the past to the Continuity IRA and attacks by the group in Fermanagh and Cavan. From as early as 2011, the Sunday World claimed McGuinness was a criminal leader in organised blockades, arson attacks and campaigns of intimidation. Phone records relating to McGuinness's number then led investigators to another number, this time a prepaid account. To identify the owner, data was linked to a credit top-up at a petrol station. CCTV footage showed a man at the station's checkout at the time of the top-up transaction. This man became known as YZ. Already involved in a murder case, he couldn't be named at the time, but he would in later years. His name was Alan Hart. Phone location data showed Hart's phone was pinging off masts running along the N55 heading south towards Mr. O'Reilly when the bleach was bought. By then retracing his movements, which included a trip to Store Street Garda Station in Dublin the day before Kevin Lunny's kidnapping, and a trip from Talbot Street to an apartment in East Wall, Gardaí slowly pieced together his movements. At the apartment in East Wall, he met a 40-year-old man called Alan O'Brien. O'Brien was wearing a black top with an Under Armour logo at the back of the neck. The men later got into a silver Kangoo van and headed north. The van had a distinctive red lightning bolt on the driver's door. It also had roof bars. It had a yellow number plate and one of the wheels was missing a hubcap. While the Gardaí in Ireland had established a route for the men, officers in the PSNI went to work on the CCTV footage. One of the automatic number plate recognition systems picked up the car in Cavan, before it was later spotted on camera in Fermanagh at Kinnaly, Kevin's neighbourhood. Some hours later, a black Audi was recorded at Derry Lynn in Fermanagh. The Kangoo van returned to Dublin that night, but headed back to Cavan the following day, the 17th of September. The man known as Hart, Alan O'Brien, and a third man, Darren Redmond, were in the van. The Audi was caught on CCTV close to Kevin's house around 6:30 that evening. Around midnight, the three men in the van were seen back at the home of Hart. tracing information on the Kangoo van proved a pivotal part of the case that the joint investigation was building. It had been bought in July in the UK and driven to Holyhead in late August. As the ferry headed back towards Ireland with the Kangoo on board, CCTV picked up a lone figure leaving the terminus. It was Cyril McGuinness. In October 2019, Gardaí seized the van. Swabs taken from blood inside the rear sliding door of the van matched Kevin Lunny. DNA inside matched that of Darren Redmond. When Detective Garda Lisa Young later searched the home of Hart, a book was found. It was called The Forensic Casebook, The Science of Crime Scene Investigation. Written by Naire Jenge, it was a best-selling book described as a must-have reference guide on understanding crime scenes. An eFlow tag that was also discovered was traced back to the black Audi. It had been left by the previous owner, who sold it to a man that August. That man was Cyril McGuinness, Dublin Jimmy. On the 8th of November 2019, a search warrant was issued for Cyril McGuinness' home in Buxton, Derbyshire, in Britain. It was around 7 a.m. when the raid began. While they searched the house, McGuinness watched the morning news on television. He was allowed to smoke and drink tea even though he was in handcuffs. He had asked for a nicotine patch too. Then he asked for his inhaler. His wife Mary heard Cyril ask if he could go outside and get some fresh air. As quickly as he said it, he collapsed. Cyril McGuinness died that morning in hospital. He had suffered a heart attack. But while the man suspected of organising Kevin's kidnapping was gone, there was ample forensic evidence to arrest the remaining four men. On the 21st of November 2019, Alan Hart, Alan O'Brien, Darren Redmond and Luke O'Reilly were charged with the abduction and torture of Kevin Lunny. In November of 2019, the same month that Gardaí arrested his suspected attackers, Kevin Lunny spoke about his ordeal for the first time. On BBC One's Spotlight programme, he relived that terrible night. Emotional at times, he recalled the torture he had endured. He told how the men who had abducted him poured bleach over his wounds, how they had scored him with the letters QIH, how they beat him and broke his leg, how he thought he was going to die. He spoke about how he had roared and screamed in pain. He was now sporting a beard. He said he had grown it to hide the scars on his face. 2 years later, in June 2021, four men went on trial for Kevin's abduction at the Special Criminal Court in Dublin. All four denied falsely imprisoning and causing serious harm to the QIH director. CCTV, DNA, phone location data, and evidence from around 250 witnesses would all feature heavily in the trial. On the opening day, Sean Guerin, senior counsel for the Director of Public Prosecutions, said the DNA, CCTV, and phone location data collected by the Gardaí and PSNI officers were linked to three of the accused: Alan Hart, Alan O'Brien, and Darren Redmond. The fourth man, Luke O'Reilly, was connected because the assault happened on his land at Drumbraid, and as the prosecutors believed, he had bought the bottle of bleach used by the attackers. It was that bottle of bleach that brought Gardaí to his door, and on the path to finding the remaining members of the gang. O'Reilly was 67 years of age at the time of the trial, and the only one of the accused from Cavan. The others, Darren Redmond, aged 27, Alan O'Brien, aged 40, and Hart, also 40, were from Dublin. Kevin Lunny was there for much of the trial, and when it came to his own testimony, he maintained his composure and calmly told his story. Much of what he had been able to memorize throughout his ordeal had presented the joint policing team with key leads. The trial judge remarked on this. He said Kevin had shown an uncanny ability to accurately estimate the passage of time, even though his attackers removed his watch early on. Kevin spoke about how he pleaded with the men not to cut off his fingers. When bleach was poured on him, he instantly knew what it was. He told the court, "I knew it was bleach. I could feel it burning my fingers. I could smell that it was bleach." When he described his beatings, he could remember being asked if they had managed to break his leg. When he replied yes, the men didn't believe him and struck his leg again and again until it broke. The bottle of bleach and where it was purchased was one of the areas of evidence covered that first week. The woman who sold the bottle took to the stand to give her account of the story. Megan McLean was hoovering a mat in Lynch's gala in Killydoon when a man came in. He had grey curly hair and was wearing a grey t-shirt and black jeans. She said he looked like a farmer. He had work clothes on and sounded like he was local. When he asked if the shop sold bleach, she pointed to a shelf in the second aisle of the shop. That man was Luke O'Reilly. "Which one is it?" O'Reilly had asked her. She went to him and picked up a 750ml bottle of Blue Domestos and said to him, "You mustn't be used to cleaning." They had laughed. When Garda Niall Dillon searched Luke O'Reilly's home, he found two bottles of Domestos under the kitchen sink. Another Garda, Gary Brennan, found a bottle in the bathroom and two more in a cabinet in a utility room. There was another in a bathroom off the kitchen. Over days, weeks, and then months, the trial continued. There were detailed and often complex testimonies around how the mobile phone records of the four men were collected. Detective Sergeant Sharon Walsh explained how phone records could only be obtained using court warrants, and this was how the data relating to the Lunny trial had been collated. While lawyers for the accused argued that the retention of mobile phone records was unlawful and impinged on rights to privacy, the evidence was allowed. Defence Barrister Michael O'Higgins said mass phone data retention was a breach of citizens' privacy rights. After 6 days of arguments over the legality of the mobile phone data and how it was collected, the evidence was eventually allowed. Questions were also raised about how the CCTV footage had been collected. It was a sticking point for the lawyers defending the men, who argued that Cavan businesses who had handed over footage to Gardaí had never been told about data privacy laws. They argued that Gardaí were using a de facto surveillance system. Andrew Gold of Gold's Timber Products in Cross Donny, County Cavan, was one of those businesses. He handed over CCTV footage to Gardaí, but had no discussion with them about what it was wanted for or data privacy laws. "I had no idea what it was about," Mr. Gold told a lawyer for Alan O'Brien. "He just let them at it," he said. Another key aspect was the involvement of deceased criminal Cyril Dublin Jimmy McGuinness. He was mentioned throughout the trial as the organiser of the alleged kidnapping and torture. The defence raised doubts over Alan O'Brien and Darren Redmond's links to the Kangoo van. That van had been burnt out while in Garda custody. It had not been properly preserved, the defence lawyers argued. Throughout the trial, none of the accused gave evidence. In November 2021, Alan O'Brien, Darren Redmond and Alan Hart were found guilty of abducting and torturing Kevin Lunny. Luke O'Reilly was acquitted. Mr. Justice Tony Hunt said that the court found Hart was the driver of the black Audi and that he was responsible for inflicting most of Mr. Lunny's serious injuries. In the absence of Cyril McGuinness, he was the ringleader. In a telling statement, the judge said he did not impose a life sentence on any of the three, because the most severe penalty should be reserved for those who finance or benefit from these types of crimes. In December of that year, the men were jailed with sentences ranging between 18 and 30 years. Alan Hart was sentenced to 30 years imprisonment, Alan O'Brien to 25 years, and Darren Redmond to 18 years, with the final three suspended. In his victim impact statement, Kevin Lunny wrote how physical scars and mental trauma of the events would remain with me and my family for the rest of our lives. In the years that have followed that terrible attack on Kevin Lunny, many changes have occurred. QIH was rebranded Maddock, and the directors continue to work in that same office in Derry Lynn. The three jailed men unsuccessfully appealed their convictions, and Alan Hart's anonymity was lifted 1 year after the trial, with the DPP adding that there was no basis to continue hiding his identity. One mystery continues to surround that awful case. Just who was the paymaster? Who was the man who had ordered Kevin Lunny's abduction and torture? Sean Quinn has always completely denied any involvement. In an interview with News Talk's The Hard Shoulder in 2023, he said, "I haven't the price of a bag of spuds. How would I be the paymaster?" Promoting his new autobiography at the time, Sean Quinn, in my own words, he said while he knew Dublin Jimmy, he didn't know him well. Referring to himself in the third person, he said, "If Sean Quinn wanted somebody to be kidnapped, something that would never cross my mind, it certainly wouldn't be Kevin Lunny. It would be people at a higher level than Kevin Lunny. I wouldn't be in favour of anyone being beaten up. It was a barbaric act. That's on the record. What I'm saying is Kevin Lunny and I were quite good friends. It wasn't his idea to take over the Quinn Group and throw me out." Father Ollie O'Reilly, the priest who gave the homily in support of Kevin in the days following his brutal attack, died in March 2026. He never revealed who he thought the paymaster was. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. We have set up an Instagram page. If you're there, please give us a follow at Lines of Inquiry Podcast. We have an email address, linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com, and we would love to hear from you, so get in touch. Whether you have a story you think we should cover, or just want to let us know how you felt about an episode, that email is linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. If you're enjoying the podcast, leaving a rating or review really helps. We've now passed 2,500 five-star ratings on Spotify, with a growing number of reviews on Apple Podcasts. Those responses make a real difference. They help new listeners find the series, and I am genuinely humbled by the response we've gotten. Thank you. Your support helps us to tell these stories. Make sure to like or follow the podcast in your podcast app, and hit the notifications button so you'll know every time a new episode is released. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Our producers are Siobhan Maguire and Siobhan Walsh. Sound editing and design is by Neil Kavanagh, with additional editing support from Ed Smith. This episode was written by Siobhan Maguire. The script editor was Owen Brennan. Social media, marketing, video, and legal support comes from the Go Loud team. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.